Our final presentation this morning is from Dr. Christine Gebbe from Columbia University School of Nursing. And her presentation is titled, From the Jaws of Defeat, Revitalizing Frameworks for Community Water Fluoridation. Dr. Gebbe.
Thank you. Thank you. I know, social workers and nurses talking about dentists at this hour of the morning is somehow an interesting mix, except that one of the funnest things about public health is its interdisciplinary nature and the fact that we mix and mingle in many ways. I confess to a failure. I didn't get the slide in that says I have no commercial interest in this process. So please take my word for that. I filed it with the association. The goal of this particular project was to identify both the successful and the unsuccessful legal challenges to community water fluoridation, look at the strategies that have been employed by the anti-fluoridationists, and then provide some insights. Just a couple of comments about this. I've spent the last, I don't know how many years now, in the question of public health infrastructure. First as a state health director in a couple of states, but then as a scholar in recent years, understanding that among the workforce, the data, and the relationships that make public health work, law is a significant piece and an often neglected piece. And that includes the enabling statutes for the agencies to exist at all, specific programmatic statutes that say you can or can't do certain things, and then the court of law as a place where people file things to get you to do one thing or another. And it was that broader interest in how law fits in that led me and a law colleague that I worked with, Ben Meyer, to apply for this funding for this particular project when CDC made it available a little while ago. And I don't need to say anything to this group about it. The population of the U.S. that has access to fluoridated water hovers around half, maybe a little more. But from a public health theory point of view, this is the easiest thing to do, because any preventive behavior that doesn't require, preventive thing that doesn't require sustained individual activity is, in general, a more sensible way to go. It's generally cheaper per gain you get out of it. And yet, in this area, we've been unable to get all the way there for what, from a scientific point of view, people think is the way to go, both from the behavioral science and from the dental science, if you will. And here's the problem. From, again, many years of observation, public health people really do believe science is the answer to everything. So when they're challenged, they tend to just yell science louder. Spend a little while with epidemiologists as they complete their epi study of a foodborne outbreak, and particularly my experience with younger ones just in practice is then they sit back and say, well, okay, we're done, as if finding the source of the outbreak solved the problem, because it would be so easy to figure it out. And if you look at a lot of what's going on around community water fluoridation, it just is repetitive. This is the good thing to do. This is the science. The unspoken piece is, can't you idiots understand this is the science? The other piece is this huge supply of well-developed materials from the anti-fluoridation groups. They have people who spend all day, as far as I can tell, all day and all night, every day, on the legal issues here. Whereas for a typical health department, particularly one of the 2,600 local health departments in the United States, your attorney is the town attorney, who most of the time is worrying about paving roads and personnel matters and what to do with tax dollars, and once every 10 years is suddenly thrown the ringer of what do you do about fluoridation. And they turn to their local health department. Most local health departments do not have a dentist. You have to be a pretty good-sized health department to have a dental director on staff. If they're in a bigger city and are aware of it, they may turn to their state health department. We have a lot of anecdotal information from the state dental directors who've been marvelous on this project, and the ADA, that sometimes major dental groups in the state forget they have a state dental director and don't necessarily link up to do things. And so we have this gap of those who have to explain why we should do it, doing it a little bit on the fly once in a while, those who are opposed to it doing it all the time. what we found when we started digging, and I'll come to my methods in a little bit, is that when you come to the merit as a public health intervention, that's rarely the issue legally, almost never. And the successful actions have been on administrative grounds, procedural and political, and then occasionally on substantive grounds, the question of who preempted it, on legislative regulatory procedures, using public referenda to get the public rousted up, and using the labeling of your actions in an interesting way, such as a clean water bill that has to do with keeping nasty stuff out of the water, fluoride being one of those nasties. So I have had the privilege in the last few years of working closely with people trained in the law. Ben Meyer, who's my co-author on this, is an attorney with a master's degree in public health and working toward actually a doctorate in public health on the issues of human rights and how public health comes together, and two other attorneys. And they know far more than I do about where to dig for this stuff. So they have been through, and we have been through, Westlaw and Lexis and all of those places that lawyers go to find information. They've also been through organizations such as the ADA and the ASTDD, the State Dental Directors, and a couple of other organizations. They spent hours and hours at the Columbia Law Library, and then at the CDC, on the phone with CDC people who did this, and got all the things you can get about law. But where things have happened at a more local level, they often don't make it into the electronically indexed files. So unless you find either a dentist, a health director, or an attorney who was involved with lawsuit number 12345 10 years ago and stuck papers in a file cabinet and remembers what file cabinet they stuffed them in and didn't clean out when they cleaned the garage, you can't get the detailed material. What you get is I remember we had a case of. The bigger stuff makes it into the electronically indexed materials. So we have put out through many sources the request for materials, and we have gotten a lot of materials. But if anybody in this room has had something to do with an obscure case that had anything to do with fluoride, and you're not sure you've sent it to us, pay attention to my email address at the end and send it to us. We don't mind duplicates. We'd rather get duplicates than not. And that what that led to then is a lot of phone calls, and people spent hours on the phone talking to folks to learn more. And these are the recurring themes. First of all, a lot of threat. If you do this, we're going to sue you. And if you're a small government or a small water system, that can be enough to bring you to your knees right there. Not knowing how you're going to defend a suit, not knowing where you're going to find the resources, not knowing how you're going to build your case, you just back off at that point. Then there are all these procedural challenges. As soon as a water system starts to do something about fluoride, all of these challenges of injunctions and preemptions and procedural questions and misuse of authority. And then finally, there are the substantive challenges, unconstitutional use of police powers and some heavy-duty things like that. And we find these themes throughout. And in fact, although we were very cautious to do it because they started thinking we were friends of anti-fluoride, their websites have incredibly detailed, helpful information if you want to pursue one of these routes. Generally, the substantive challenges go to constitutional authority. And I can almost sound like a lawyer. Please forgive me, any attorneys in the room. But where somebody tries that substantive challenge and it goes up through the courts, it generally falls apart. If you're willing to stick with it and appeal what looks like a bad decision at a lower level, you can generally get it thrown out. Police powers of the state are upheld in this case as a good thing to do within the authority of the state to do it. And it's not been found to infringe on religion under the First Amendment. It's not been found to be a due process fault under the 14th Amendment. And it's not found to be an invasion of privacy under the 9th Amendment. So we've got good precedent, if you can stick to it, that you can get there. But it's often a long way from here to there. Procedural challenges, on the other hand, are the other piece. I think here I'm looking back on my own career and staff I've worked with a lot in a lot of places. We kind of think we know the procedures, so we kind of do them without rereading the book every time? These people are reading the book every time. You put the comma in the wrong place. You file it on the wrong day of the week, in the wrong room, at the wrong place, and they will drive a truck through you on procedural matters. So that in this particular case, procedure almost completely outweighs substance. That if somebody is starting to challenge fluoridation in your area, you absolutely have to follow every procedural step down to the last little bitty piece. And they're looking at how you're going about doing it. Did you follow the procedure? Was it within your municipal authority given the local home rule rules in your state? How were petitions and referenda collected? And then this wonderful thing about a substance that lacks FDA approval, which apparently rattles everybody's cage. It remains in the local water supply, despite challenges, primarily in places where there's a state preemption that says fluoridation is a state issue and that state says it's okay and good to do. And so I think one of the end results of this is going to be some model state legislation that might come out. Here's an example of how they go about these pre-litigation challenges. I love this one. They went around the Arkansas legislature and handed out toothpaste and had little cards that pointed out that fluoride is an option using toothpaste. And I choose not to have it, so please respect my right to choose. Right to choose is a great American phraseology. It worked. So where we are in this project is about halfway done. And I've actually moved schools in the middle of this. We've moved the project with me over to Hunter College and lost, I don't know if you've tried to move a grant from school A to school B or agency A to agency B, but you lose a couple of months in the whole process of paperwork. But we clearly have discovered that you can't focus on just the litigation. You've got to focus on these challenges within the legislature and on these local challenges on procedure. And so we're now ready to start this next phase, which is a compendium of best procedures. Our concern is where do we put the best procedures so we don't just put them out there so the anti-fluoridationists can find them and figure out a way around us, since we're trying to figure out a way around them. Again, I invite any brilliant notions, bearing in mind that the legal people who need this don't know they need it till they need it and need to know how to get at it quickly. And that's a real enormous challenge. I do want to thank the CDC, which has funded this as a cooperative agreement. These two young women who are attorneys with a strong interest in public health who've done a lot of the legwork on the project for me and for Ben. And all of those people who have sent us references, I couldn't begin to count them. And there's a mix of my previous Columbia site, but my Hunter email, and really want to thank you all for this chance to talk about it.
We've got about a half an hour for questions, so fire away.
For Dr. Gebbie, does the FDA have a position on fluoride? Your slide indicates.
Why don't we have all of the speakers come up to the front?
Yeah. Its use in drinking water, I don't think, comes under their purview, so they haven't said anything about it. They're silent on it. And that gives people a chance to use their silence to mean something when it doesn't really mean anything. At least that's my understanding.
Yes, sir. I have a question for Dr. Hughes.
Sure.
For kids who had several
the question was treatment generally, so that what we captured was any kind of treatment. Healthy kids mirrors healthy families, and you could probably help me here in terms of what kind of inpatient services are covered under healthy families for dental services. Do you know?
I think the dental, are you asking me?
Yes, Bob. Inpatient. So that, so that the answer is that that that, that is, because it's self-report, it's probably whatever parents defined as treatment.
While you're on your data set, I'd like to ask you, you showed something like $200 plus or, for unmet dental needs, and $400 plus for, or $400,000 for medical, with a total of $700,000 plus. My question is, just, you know, that's like the cost. The question is, whether did you find some unmet medical needs?
Yeah, this what I presented was the annual average cost for all services and then broken down by dental and versus everything else. So that some of that was unmet, some of it was met.
But you attributed the dental piece to a lot of unmet need. Was the medical expense also attributable to unmet medical need?
Well, I'm not sure that I can, yes. I mean, that's speculation that it's attributable to unmet need. But yes, there was sizable unmet medical need as well. Joint application for all three programs, and the hierarchy is to try for Medi-Cal first, and then to look at Healthy Families and Healthy Kids secondarily.
So they had to apply for the other two in order to get on to this.
Well, they didn't have to technically apply. They go through this. It's electronically done, so they go through the algorithm for determining whether or not they're eligible for Medi-Cal. Based on the health, the certified application assister's determination, well, you're not my assessment is you're not eligible for that, so we're going to screen you for these other two programs. And the vast majority of these kids in both Santa Clara and San Mateo who are enrolled in Healthy Kids programs, I don't know what the data are in LA, are undocumented. So they're ineligible because of their documentation status.
Like in San Diego, we have similar program, but ours actually has to prove that they went through and be rejected by the school.
That's not the case in these. Okay. There's the CAA is responsible for making sure that we're doing those determinations.
So
it happens through the electronics, so through 1EM.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there an option for children who perhaps have Kaiser for medical, but they don't, father may work, low income, doesn't qualify, doesn't have any dental insurance, or like in San Francisco, children who are on the San Francisco health plan and there's no dental, are there options for them?
Unfortunately, no. And it's a big problem. I mean, in my estimation, it's mirrored after Healthy Families, and Healthy Families does not allow for just for dental coverage, and so the Healthy Kids programs is not either.
Do you have any idea what it costs to provide the patient navigator services per person?
It's a good question. I don't. But the total grant was about $200,000 a year. It's about $400,000 for a two-year study. That would be something we should look at. Yeah, definitely.
Larry, for the Chicago program, I know I was writing something else you said and missed the piece about you have 200,000 visits, and you don't medical visits in your site?
We have 200,000 unique patients.
Pardon me?
200,000 unique patients.
Unduplicated patients. Unduplicated patients, and no dental services? Do you have
dental services? Do we offer dental services, are you asking?
Do you provide dental care within your center?
One of our health centers is a dental center. The rest would be, if they're involved in this Big Smiles program, it would be the primary care provider providing some selected oral health services to the kids.
But didn't you say all the clinics were FQHCs?
We are FQHC, yes.
Therefore, don't you have dental?
We don't have dentists. We have one health center that is a dental center.
But don't you have a relationship with dental if you don't provide the dental care under the roof of the medical facility if you are an FQHC?
Can everybody speak up a little up there?
I'm curious. I thought that if you are an FQHC, you either must provide dental care under your roof or have a relationship with a dentist in the community to take referrals.
Well, technically speaking, if you don't have dental, you're required to provide or arrange for prevention that's technically.
Okay.
And in reality, there are, you know, the sites that don't have dental usually don't do that. But so the question is if, you know, if this is happening and assessments are being done on all these kids, mm-hmm. and we're getting the fluoride varnish, which is a very important part of it, but then also we're doing assessments. So when children are assessed as having treatment needs, and that will be a growing number as you get to more sites and more providers, then what happens to those kids?
We have created a list of dentists.
Pardon me?
We've created a list of dentists that will accept public aid patients and that will see really young kids, and so we would help the family get an appointment with that dentist. A couple of our academic health centers also provide emergency, you know, if it's a surgery that's needed or something like that, that we could refer them to also.
Do you collect any data on that, like of the kids that were referred, how many of those kids successfully got into care?
That's a next step. I think we have that kind of on the to-do list, yeah. Access is an organization of 50 health centers throughout the Chicagoland area, and we're an FQHC.
And only one of those has a dental component to it.
Correct.
So with that size of a patient population, is there some reason that you haven't sought to add dental components to your centers?
I also work at the same organization. 20 of our locations are co-located with dentists under the same roof.
Huh.
So even though they're not officially part of Access, we're integrated in terms of the ability to refer. So we do have more access to dental than specifically what is within our organization formally.
So are they some of the dental homes? Or
definitely, yes.
And then for Dana, I was curious, you reported on 4 and 5 year olds, but with all the attention on, you know, 0 to 3, and especially since you did this for those 5, mm-hmm. which is very interested in 0 to 5, which is some reason.
Yeah, there was a peculiar reason, and as I recall, and I'll look this up to make sure, but I think it was because the numbers were just so itty-bitty that we had to pull them out. That's my recollection. But we initially targeted 0 to 5, and for some reason, because there was only 138 kids, I believe, in that age group to start with, and they were all, the vast majority were ages 4 to 5, so I think that's the reason, but I will double-check. I could be speaking out of turn. But it was a methodological reason.
Jane?
I have a question for Dr. Debbie. In your compendium, will you be including information about cities now that are going about taking and removing water fluoridation?
We have cases of people removing it, trying to add it, failing to add it. We have, the full range. And a number of these challenges that we've analyzed are in places where there has been fluoride and it is being removed, or there's been a proposal to remove it.
Are you seeing more of that discussion?
I don't think we've quantified it. I certainly hear a fair bit about that.
I'd like to ask Dr. Mosen a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, when you got people interested in dental and they sought out care,
right?
Did they have any pathology?
We didn't know that when we contacted them. I assume some did. They were new to the dental program. So I would assume so.
Or were they healthy mouths and they figured there was no need to go see it?
I think it was both. It was both. Yeah.
And is your program still in place or has it lapsed?
It's not in place anymore. No.
All right, have you had a chance to see whether those whom you motivated to get care have relapsed to bad behavior,
right,
or are they continually having instilled in them the spirit of getting dental care?
Right, that's something we could probably look at. We haven't done that yet. But yeah, that would be interesting to see.
Yes, sir.
Have any of you, in particular Jan, did you develop a curriculum to teach doctors, nurses, how to do a dental assessment?
Part of the Bright Smiles from Birth curriculum that was developed by the Illinois chapter of the AAP and the Illinois pediatric dentists, and those 5 groups that I listed covered all of that information about early childhood caries, how to do a visual oral health assessment, applying the fluoride varnish, risk and protective factors for oral health. So it kind of covered that whole
spectrum. Is it documented? Do you have like a step-by-step kind of document that you could that could be replicated for other health professionals to learn how to do a dental assessment?
I mean, I have the training slides. I don't know. I think it would be, they're kind of owned, I guess, by the Illinois chapter of the AAP.
Yeah,
I know that the Illinois does.
There's a variety of curricula that are out there. AAP has one on their website. The Academy of Family Physicians have another one. The Wisconsin Department of Health has one.
And I've got one.
Contacting your local American Academy of Pediatric chapter if it's something you're interested in putting in one of your sites.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
For Dr. Gebbie, you mentioned the possibility after you're looking at things that you could see more state legislation. Can you give an idea of what kind of legislation you're talking about?
The most successful stand firm to keep fluoride there seems to be where there is a state law that supports fluoridation as a local option as an option and doesn't allow the local community to preempt that. I'm not saying it right because my lack of legal training comes out here. And I think we may try to show at least the outlines of what such a statute would look like, bearing in mind that getting it through many state legislatures could be a real bear.
There's been 20 attempts from 2007, from 2000 to 2007, I know, at least 20 attempts, all of which failed. This last year, there were two that passed, and the one that passed in Nebraska is going to result in 60 cities voting to opt out fluoridation next Tuesday, which is your basic nightmare. So you have to be very careful about state legislation.
Yeah, it depends on how it's worded and how the opt-out or opt-in is developed.
We've got about three more minutes in this room before we have to clear it out to the next group. So any more questions or any of our speakers? Yes, sir.
I have a question for Dan. Dan, you mentioned your program. Did you partner with any local Head Start program because they were doing the same things that you mentioned in your program, like giving the list out, doing fluoride varnishes, and also education to the parents?
We have not formally had any partnerships. We do have some caseworkers and case managers that within Access that work with some of those same populations, and we certainly try and coordinate all of that information. But as far as the services that happen at our health center, I would say probably no, we don't.
Okay.
Quick question for Jan. You mentioned in your mentoring you use pediatric dentists.
At the time we started the program with the Illinois chapter of the AAP, the pediatric dentist is what was available for the training. But I know now they are starting to train some hygienists in the program, so we would certainly be open to using them. It's just that was kind of the logistics at the time.
Any other questions?
I would say, you know, there were two issues that we came across in calling the patients. One was accepting public aid, which may be a third to a half said that they did. The other question was seeing kids under the age of three, which was another big kind of roadblock. And again, I would say maybe a third to a half did. Now, whether it was the same third or half, I.
Any other questions? Well, big hand for all of our presenters.
He is in the back, and we're moving to the
I've heard that coming is better for the sanctuary. Illinois practice is a Democratic practice. Works at the state's certain university.
True or false? I believe that's true, but I'm not. not the best person to know that question. Maybe I'm not answering.
Thank you very much.
I
really appreciate your presentation.
Did you keep a lot of files on it?
Probably not a lot.
took this new certified in public health exam. Because I'm on that, yeah, and passed. And despite my biostatistics, I passed. I went through the study guide. Yeah, I'm on that cool board. That's why they really leaned on us to take it. I got the study guide from the Schools of Public Health, and it really was helpful. And it was useful to just go through that, and you could look up things and reasons. Hang in there. What was interesting was those of us who had been in practice a while tend to do better than the new ones.
Good.
A little seasoning apparently helps.
Good.
Well, my husband was getting advice and I'm trying to work out that he can get out of that office that my company will find that will help him actually go out and do the health assessments. So I'm trying to get all that together.
Wow.
I know, and I'm I'm an epidemiologist.
It's going to be at the Santa Rosa, which is down there.
If I can sneak out of my other thing, I'll come. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to ask you, too. I'm going to be doing the program planning next year, and water's the theme. And I was thinking we might do something on fluoridation advocacy.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to present at that session?
Sure. We'll be a lot farther down the road by then.
Right. I would really. May I have your card?
Sure.
I would really be interested in doing something a little different. I think that might be something.
That's a great idea. Yes.
So let me talk to some folks. Okay. I will do that. Thank you again very much.
You're very welcome. It's fun to do.
Can I get your card as well?
Sure.
Oh,
good. There you go.
Thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
Jump in as soon as.
Okay.
Yeah, but
all
it
right.
Sounds like you're on your way, though. So,
all right. How did you get into dental health, woman? Come on.
Well, how did you? How did you? I'm looking.
Law is infrastructure.
Okay. Do I see you have a different card?
I do.
Else?
I do.
You do. You do.
I, what the heck I said? You know me.
Yes.
I'm dean of a nursing school.
Oh, my God. Isn't that great?
It's a hoot. I started in September. I am having a ball.
You know, Marla's come out to University of Washington.
I know. I had lunch with her last week.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
See her, say hi. Tell her I just miss her tremendously. And so I was actually going to come over and listen to your thing because I see it and I thought, oh, I have to be there to go, hi, Chris. This is my role in life, isn't it?
Yes.
And but I ran into Bobby Berkowitz instead, so Bobby and I sat and had a cup of coffee, and I said, I'm going to still try to rush over there and get at the end so I can say,
good for
and
you.
Then David Mosen, David used to work for me at Care Oregon.
Well, I assume
so,
he did.
You know, it's kind of like, and now he's a kind of...
Yeah, and Bob Eichner, too.
Really?
Yeah. Hello.
Just,
it is a small world.
Well, and the thing is that Oregon has, screwed up fluoridation so badly so many times, and actually the Northwest Health Foundation asked us to pull together yet another kind of group to look at what are we going to do and how are we going to do it. We're going to take a rest this session because it needs a rest.
No, the bottom line is procedural.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with science, and it all rests on the procedures you use and using them absolutely perfectly.
Yes.
All the way down the line.
Exactly. And getting all the crazy personalities that are involved in this to kind of all realize that we're shooting each other in the foot, and so we've got to stop this. So we've got a couple, crazies at the state. We've got, the Dental Association that has its own brand. We've got, and so it's all these, and then, and some really dedicated, wonderful people, Kurt Frey from Kaiser. retiring as a dentist there, and he's kind of single-handedly been trying to lead this thing. And it's like,
if you were going to have a kickoff,
yes,
think about inviting Ron Wyden to come back and talk about his analysis of the Multnomah County process when it succeeded,
yes,
and how he brought the Great Panthers in. Because if you remember, they tipped the vote yes in the first vote.
Really? Okay.
Yes. And the fact that the removal vote, you know,
yes,
which happened very shortly,
yes,
thereafter, was in a by-election, and he had gotten distracted to other things and didn't turn out the seniors, is one of the reasons it failed. That's Gebbie back of the cup analysis. But I know it wouldn't have been yes the first time,
yes,
if he hadn't gotten the seniors to say, it's not only good for my grandkids, it's good for my bones.
Yes.
And it made a huge difference in the turnout.
Well, and Jerry Coogan, the new guy in charge of AARP, is a nice guy, and I have gotten to know him a little bit. I mean, so the seniors, kind of a broad coalition.
It really does.
And it's going to take, some real dedicated people,
right,
who are good strategists to put the plan together and execute.
I've never met a strategist who is better than Ross.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was he was a little baby politician back then.
Yeah.
And I see him every once in a while on the shuttle plane between New York and Washington. We always say hi. He always remembers me, which astonishes me. And we always say we're going to get together, and then we never quite do it. But,
yeah.
He's just a good guy.
Well, when are you going to come out to Oregon again? Come on, come see us.
Oh,
we miss you.
I should.
Yes.
Give me an excuse.
Oh, okay. Maybe now that I know
really
you talk on fluoridation. This is a whoa. Okay.
Yeah.
We're forced out. Well, I mean, I got a whole bunch of things that I know, but it's like,
with this year.
Yeah, I was like, hey, this is great.
Well, she has a habit of popping out. We do this to each other.
This funny thing.
In unexpected scenes,
yeah,
on topics neither of us expect the other one to be there. So I was like,
hello. Here we are.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. The funniest one was LaSalle in Pittsburgh.
Oh,
I did
that was. That takes the cake.
That does take the cake. Well, anyway, take care.
Thanks. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Bye-bye.
Resource for any